Welcome to In the Hive, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're going down a little bit of a rabbit hole, following our curiosity. A couple of weeks ago, I was walking around downtown Salt Lake City, saw a sign advertising something that I didn't recognize, snapped a photo, and sent it to fellow producer Tim Pierce.
Yep.
Howdy, Tim.
Hey, Roger.
So the photo I took was of a shop on 300 South with an awning stretching out over the sidewalk. And that awning had a word on it that I just wasn't familiar with. It was...
Kratom, 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 kratum. I prefer kratom, but the most common pronunciation is kratom.
At the time that I started working on it, people were calling it either kratom or kratom. And for whatever reason, I leaned towards kratom.
Here we usually say kratom, you know, just a hard kratom. And then in the eastern United States, they usually say kratom or kratom. And then in Indonesia, you know, it differs a little bit, but the people who know, you know, what kratom is there, they'll say something like kratom.
So what is kratom, kratum, kratom, or however you pronounce it, what is it?
That is what we are going to try to get to the bottom of today, Tim. Okay, the short answer to your question, though, is that it's a plant, the leaves of which are used as a medicine. But depending on who you ask, kratom is as benign as tea or coffee, or alternatively, it's a dangerous, potentially addictive narcotic.
Whoa, okay. That is a huge spectrum between those two things.
I know. Just hold your horses for a second, Tim. For an overview of what this plant is, I spoke with this guy.
I'm Jack Henningfield. I'm Vice President of Research, Health Policy, and Abuse Liability at Pinney Associates, and I am an adjunct professor of behavioral biology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
He's a medical researcher who has a little bit of a disclaimer to offer before we continue.
My consulting includes developing safer medicines for pain and addiction, and I advise the American Kratom Association on the science related to kratom.
So he's a kratom, that's what we're going with, right?
Yeah.
So he's a kratom proponent?
Yeah, you know, first and foremost, he's a scientist, and he really is one of the experts out there on this topic, though. Yeah, as he said, he consults with the American Kratom Association, which is the sort of lobby for kratom and kratom consumers in the United States. But before we get too far into the weeds here, let's get Henningfield's overview. Is that all right?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Well, kratom refers to the leaves that come from a tree that is in the coffee family. So although we hear a lot about kratom associated with opioids, which come from the opium poppy family, this is a totally different animal or plant, if you will. It comes from a tree in the coffee family, and not surprisingly, it has some effects that are coffee-like. A lot of people use kratom as a morning pick-me-up and to focus and for energy. Those are not things that people use opioids for. But kratom also does have some opioid effects, and that includes helping relieve pain and produces some constipating effects or relieves diarrhea. But, and this is really critical, the two signature effects of real opioids, like morphine and heroin and fentanyl, are respiratory depression, and that's what kills people, and a powerful, brain-rewarding, addictive euphoriant effect. And kratom is very low on both of those, so that puts it in a totally different class.
Opioids and morphine, I don't understand how you can just walk into a shop and buy this little leaf.
You know, in a half dozen states and a few cities, San Diego, for example, you can't. Kratom is banned. But then there are a whole bunch of states, 39 actually, where it isn't banned or regulated in any way. And then there are four states where there are regulations as a way to sort of ensure that what you're getting is the real deal. And Tim, I bet you can guess what one of those states is.
Maryland.
Guess again.
Utah.
Correct.
Yes.
Do you want to know how that happened?
Inform me.
Okay. Well, for that regulation to occur here in Utah, a lawmaker had to take action, obviously.
Obviously.
And so we will bring in another voice here.
My name is Kurt Bramble, state senator from Utah's Senate District 16, which is basically Provo Orem, and I go up the canyon to Wallsburg.
Senator Bramble sponsored the Utah Kratom Consumer Protection Act at this year's legislative session. It was the first bill of its kind in any of these here United States of ours, And here's what it does.
So the Kratom Consumer Protection Act does a couple of things. First of all, it says that if someone is going to sell kratom in the state of Utah, their product has to be independently lab certified as to its purity. You can't adulterate, which means you can't mix the kratom with any other chemicals. You can't synthesize the alkaloids, the mitragynine or the 7-hydroxymitragynine. That's what the plant produces, and it produces it in very low percentages naturally occurring. So the Kratom Consumer Protection Act says if it's pure kratom, the concentration of those alkaloids can be no more than what's found in the plant naturally occurring. So you can't adulterate, you can't concentrate, you can't synthesize the alkaloids. And you have to label the product so that consumers, this bottle of kratom right here, you'll see it has labeling, you know, what's in the contents. This particular company has been kind of on the cutting edge of consumer protection, wanting to make certain that their products meet a much higher standard, okay?
Okay, so does Senator Bramble carry a tiny little bottle of kratom like in his suit pocket wherever he goes?
No, actually it was on his desk at his office in the Utah State Capitol.
That makes a lot more sense. But I'm still curious, why does the state senator care so much about kratom?
You know what? I've got a piece of tape for that as well.
A year ago, I knew nothing about kratom. I hadn't heard of it. I've been very much involved during my time in the Senate on drug abuse. Every family has been touched by opioid addiction. And when someone is addicted to opioids, when they're addicted to drugs, honesty goes out the window, their character, whatever. We have six children. One of my children got caught up in the drug culture. Matter of fact, her husband actually died what we believe was an opioid overdose.
Okay, so this is personal for him. But didn't that, Dr.
Henningfield.
Henningfield, right. Didn't he say kratom triggers similar brain receptors as opioids? So you'd think that Senator Bramble might not be on board with that, let alone have a bottle of it on his desk.
You know, let's actually hear from Dr. Henningfield again, who has compiled a lot of research on kratom, and maybe he can fill in some gaps here. What kind of evidence do we have on the effectiveness of this plant to treat pain or addiction?
Well, the first line of evidence is what we call the surveillance and field studies from Southeast Asia, where kratom grows on trees and people use it commonly, and it is also marketed there. And for decades, in fact, going back to the early 20th century, people were using it in place of opioids. And in fact, Thailand banned kratom in the early 20th century because the government had a monopoly on opioids, and it was basically cutting into the government's business. So people were using it there in place of opioids for pain. And for people that got into trouble with opioids, they used it to get off of the opioids. And when they made the transfer to kratom, they got their lives back in a nutshell. We've seen the same thing happen here in the United States over the last couple of decades. And how do we know that? Well, we have four public surveys. Two of them are published. The other two have been presented on websites and at scientific meetings of more than 20,000 people. And they tell us the same thing. There are a lot of people using to treat their and manage their opioid withdrawal and get off of opioids. And a lot of those people are rightfully scared to death of a kratom ban that would take away this far more safe substitute for opioids and leave them either with the option of going back to opioids or the black market kratom, which would certainly spring up very quickly.
Okay, I see. So, potentially, this could be a sort of silver bullet of sorts for the opioid epidemic, if this is all true.
Yeah, and you know, actually, after we stopped recording in his office up at the state capitol, Senator Bramble, who again sponsored that kratom legislation, he told me that he thought maybe his son-in-law would still be alive if he had had access to kratom, because Senator Bramble believes it lessens the cravings for opioids, you know, for people who are addicted, but without all of the negative side effects. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, though, Tim. Not a lot of research has been done on that claim. I mean, some has, and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, people self-reporting that it helps you with opioid withdrawal or that it relieves pain. But yeah, it hasn't been thoroughly evaluated yet. The FDA at one point said they were going to list it as a Schedule 1 drug, like marijuana or cocaine, but they haven't actually done that. I'm going to quickly point out that we reached out to the FDA for comment, and they directed us to a page on their website that lays out a number of warnings. And in fact, they warn consumers not to use kratom. They say it appears to have properties that expose users to risks of addiction, abuse, and dependence, and that it affects the same opioid brain receptors as morphine. But they go on to say that they're actively researching it, and though they warn consumers not to use it, they also ask consumers to report any adverse effects directly to them. A lot of the concerns from the FDA, and actually at one point the DEA, had to do with what kratom might be cut with. And then there were some shipments of kratom from Indonesia that were tainted with salmonella. That caused some warnings as well. But the truth here is that the jury is kind of out on whether kratom might be addictive, whether it might be harmful, whether it might have the benefits a lot of people claim it has. And just to reiterate that point, here's Barbara Inslee Crouch, executive director of the Utah Poison Control Center.
Without having a full understanding of the spectrum of adverse effects and the dose-response relationship of those adverse effects, it's hard to make an opinion on that, on whether or not it really is safe and we should allow people to use it and make use their own judgment, or whether or not there are, significant risks.
I forgot to have her introduce herself.
Roger, you got to have them say their name. You got to have them spell their name. And you have to have them tell you what they had for breakfast. Always.
I know. I've been doing this for a while, Tim. I promise. So Barbara Inslee Crouch from the Poison Control Center went on to say that her center does get reports of overdoses and hospitalizations from kratom, and that there have been deaths attributed to kratom, and that we don't know exactly how it reacts with other drugs and so on and so on. But again, from the research side, the jury is still basically out. However, that doesn't mean that an industry isn't already up and running here in the state of Utah, right, Tim?
Right. So remember that photo that you sent me of the awning advertising kratom in downtown Salt Lake?
Yep.
So I actually decided to go and investigate, and I spoke to this guy.
Yeah, so my name's Joel Badger. That's J-O-E-L, last name B-A-D-G-E-R. And I'm a partner here at Grow Kratom.
Nailed it.
So Joel is the guy behind the awning, the man in the store. And he and I had a conversation about his business, how he got involved, and about some of the regulations in place around all of this.
Okay, well, let's take a listen.
How did you get into this business?
I was researching, or I guess I was just online and looking around, and there was an article on it. I think it was probably about the DEA ban. They were trying to ban it in 2016, or they were looking into it. When they went to do that, a couple hundred thousand Americans kind of stood up and just said, no, we've been using this, it's been helpful for us, nobody's getting hurt, and we want to continue using it. So they had a public comment period, and during that period, thousands and thousands of people sent in their stories, sent in, letters and calls and everything. And then the DEA just backed off and just decided, it was like 99% of all the comments were positive. So they just backed off and allowed kratom to be as it is. The FDA is a different story, but the DEA is, currently not interested in enforcing anything against kratom or scheduling it. It's just not their priority, it looks like.
Who buys kratom?
We get people from every walk of life. Literally, it's the weirdest thing. I'll see, someone who's 20 years old and going to college and, really needs the energy from it. We'll see people. I had someone come in the other day that was like 80 years old, limping in, was having issues with things, and just heard about it on the internet, came in with his daughter. And, of course, we can't sell it for medical purposes. People will do their research, online and find that some people have been using it for medical use and then come in and, purchase it for that use. And it just seems like, there's a whole bunch of things that make it such a broad user base. I mean, it's people who feel stressed. It's literally everyone. It's people who need better sleep. It's people who, need daily relief, that kind of stuff.
So is that mostly what you use it for? Just like getting up in the morning, helping with your anxiety?
We have, everything from the darker kratom that's more sedating to kind of the middle range, which is more like mood enhancing, You know, some people would use that for relief. And then towards the more energizing side, that's usually what people use, you know, as like a coffee replacement. You know, that's what I prefer, is the more energizing and kind of mood enhancing side. But I think in general, the more relaxing side is a little more common. We do have some people that use it just because they like it, you know, and it's kind of like, the question's kind of like, do people use coffee recreationally? And it's like, I mean, kind of. It's like they're, you know, if you're trying to get some energy to, you know, go do your stuff for the day, that's enjoyable to have energy. And I think that's why a lot of people, you know, go for Kratom. It's just one of those things that it just makes you feel a little more normal during the day.
The Kratom Consumer Protection Act.
Yeah.
Why is that important?
It's really important is that because it was the first act that any state put out to keep Kratom available for customers and for, you know, their constituents. So, you know, when we told them, like, people are using this as a replacement for harder drugs, nobody has died from Kratom overdose alone. We had a few people from the American Kratom Association come and testify. I went there as a local business owner and testified and just told them, like, you know, I've seen, you know, thousands of people have this by now, and, you know, the vast majority of them are using it responsibly. You know, they decided right there, you know, they passed it. Every one of those was, you know, every step of that process was approved. It's amazing because all these other states were kind of waiting, and then Utah, you know, just out of nowhere, you know, Utah is very conservative. You know, I'm a little conservative myself, and, you know, it's just one of those states that saw the science and understood it well enough, and it was open enough to the supplement industry to regulate it and essentially keep it available. We were selling it online for a couple years prior, and then when that came about, you know, it just allowed businesses to feel safe. You know, we never quite felt safe with, you know, the FDA looming over us, you know, seizing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds. And then when this law came about to make Kratom a dietary supplement, we just knew, you know, a shop would be a good way to go. You know, there's nothing holding us back now. The Utah Department of Food and Agriculture is regulating us, and they come and do inspections. So they're essentially keeping us safe from the FDA just on the basis that they want to keep their, you know, they want to keep Utah safe. So that, it changed a ton for us. I've always pushed to be on the side of, you know, testing and correct packaging and, you know, safety. And for a while, that was just not, that wasn't supported. It wasn't, there was no incentive.
Okay, so a businessman. I liked that he wasn't making any medical claims, and not doing that is, of course, a hallmark of the supplement industry that is so prevalent here in Utah.
Yes and no. It's regulated like an herbal supplement, but a lot of the conversation, at least we've heard around Kratom, involves its ability to sort of mimic opioids, which isn't something, you know, most supplements do.
So not your typical essential oil is what you're saying.
No, not by any means. And so far, at least as we have presented this, Kratom sounds pretty controversial, with grand potential for good and bad.
And so we wanted to dig a little deeper on the actual effects of Kratom and what it does to the human body. And so, Tim, you just yesterday had a conversation with someone who has a tad more scientific and health education than either of us.
Well, you know, I'd like to consider myself a bit of a scientist. But yes, the man I spoke to has at least one more doctorate than I do.
My name is Glenn Hansen, and I'm a professor in dentistry and pharmacology at the University of Utah.
I love these audio introductions.
And I had for breakfast granola.
What did Dr. Hansen have to say about all of these claims about Kratom, Tim?
So he had a really interesting take. Considering who we have talked to so far, his perspective was a bit pragmatic and a little, Kratom isn't really being studied by pharmaceutical companies or the federal government. Why do you think that is?
I think it just doesn't have that much of a social impact at this stage. It's sort of a niche drug it's culturally relevant because the source, the tree that it comes from, is mainly grown in Southeast Asia. And so the culture that is most interested, that grew up with it, is probably coming from the Polynesian islands. And you're going to see it either on the West Coast or see it out in the Pacific. And once it gets a culture or a following and you start to see people talk about it on the internet and others decide to get into the marketplace and actually manufacture this stuff with some kind of quality control. I mean, that's always an issue when you've got something that's not being regulated very tightly. Then you may see more and more people who try it. It's not a terribly potent drug generally, but you can get addicted to it. There are some people who get dependent on it, just like they get dependent on other opioid narcotics. But it takes an effort to do it. You have to do a lot. You have to take high quantities of it in order to really drive that opioid system to the point where dependence has been developed.
It's so bizarre to me that it stands in this like weird nebulous sort of frame of, you know, it's a plant, it's not that bad. I mean, it can get addictive, but you can get addicted to caffeine, but also it can help you get off opioids, and it's still like people take it recreationally. Like, how do I make sense of all of that? I don't know. Is that a fair question?
What kind of sense do you want to make? When you go into the world of drug abuse and addiction, sometimes things never do really make sense. There are cultural things that get involved, population things, generational things, demographic things, all of this, you bring it to the mix. And who knows how it's going to turn out. Sometimes the government plays a big role in terms of what do they want to regulate something. Sometimes it's just, has anybody died from it that has a big name? And can we attach a discussion based on a personality who has succumbed to it or hasn't succumbed to it? It's very haphazard. And if there isn't a problem, even though a drug may be potentially very dangerous, if there isn't a problem with it, then why invest a lot of money in trying to regulate it or control it or even study it? No one actually uses it, then who cares?
Why do you think it's finding this niche in like Western culture?
America, like now?
Like Utah. Why is there legislation for it if you're like, eh?
Well, niches come and niches go. So do I think it's got staying power to it? I'd be surprised. You know, I'd be surprised because, one, it's not particularly potent. It's fairly subtle. And other things out there will do basically the same. And they'll come from products that are fairly well controlled and fairly well integrated into the culture. You know, like you mentioned, its stimulant properties aren't that different from caffeine. And I've got lots of places I can go to get caffeine. I don't need to buy something like an exotic kratom unless I'm trying to impress somebody. So I just don't see it having a unique pharmacology that will drive it. It hasn't got that, at least I've ever seen.
How efficacious do you think it is to treating opioid addictions? And I think that's like Senator Bramble's like main selling point. This is it. This is gonna solve all of our problems. This little leaf.
Like, right.
Well, what is your perspective on that?
I've been in this business for a long time, so my research has been drug abuse since the early 1980s. I was the acting director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse back at NIH. And so I directed $1 billion budget each year to look at research into addiction. And I've been able to see certain patterns occur. Some of them are drug dependent. Some of them are fairly addiction dependent. And it really doesn't matter which drug. You could substitute in heroin for methamphetamine, for cocaine. Even though the pharmacology is very different, the process is very similar. And so the bottom line is that there are those drugs, as I say, that have kind of staying power. And this one, this kratom isn't even like, it's not even that interesting in terms of its pharmacology because the effects are so weak that I don't think it's got staying power. If there isn't some cultural thing that will make it more alluring and more interesting to potential users, you're not going to use it. There's nothing in there that says, wow, I've got to have this every morning in order to survive. Those that have integrated into their culture usually have grown up with it. And so it's kind of like, I really like milk. I wake up in the morning and I have to have my milk. But I wouldn't consider it an addicting drug. I would consider it more of a cultural thing that I'm used to. And I think kratom is sort of that way. That's why it tends to be kind of culturally sensitive. It's a little harder to develop a market in a group of people who've never seen it until they're adults. And they, it wasn't all that interesting when I used it. So I don't think I'll waste any time or any money on it.
So, all right, in his mind, pretty cut and dry, kind of not a big deal.
Right, yeah. He says that to some cultures, it's really important. But to us, it's a fad.
And whether or not it's a passing fad is a sort of open question. You know what's missing from this conversation, Tim, is a firsthand account of someone who has tried kratom. And I have a sort of truncated version of that, Senator Bramble's own account. He tried it himself.
I tried kratom twice. I had a pulled muscle in my hip, and I tried kratom. It mitigated the pain. There were no side effects whatsoever. When you say, won't people get high? The only time people are getting high on kratom is kratom that is laced with other narcotics or barbiturates or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'd like to have dug deeper into what using kratom is actually like.
I can provide some insight, actually.
Okay, so you tried this.
Yeah, well, so, okay, I mean, it was being compared to tea and coffee. There's a state senator who's a big proponent of it. I thought, you know, how dangerous could this be? Also, I was especially curious.
Okay, so what was it like for you? And can you describe, you know, how did you actually take it?
I took it with water, as was recommended to me. You're supposed to take about a gram if you have never taken kratom before. And the little bag I bought holds 30 grams. So I poured what I assumed was a 30th of that bag into a little cup, stirred it around with the water that I put in there, and then I chugged it because it tastes like grass. And then about 10 minutes later, I felt good. And then about 20 minutes after that, I felt bad. And I felt nauseous and like I wanted to throw up.
Ooh. Huh. Okay, so throwing up. But I guess, would you recommend it? I know you weren't treating any specific ailment. You know, you didn't have pain. The question I have is, would you recommend this to anybody else?
I would talk to your doctor before considering taking kratom.
Talk to your doctor is exactly what the Utah Poison Control Center's Barbara Inslee Crouch told me.
I mean, my advice to the general population would be to work with their primary care provider, their physician, on what is the best course of action for them with their underlying medical history, and your doctor is the person who's going to know that best. And so to come up with a plan that's monitored and safe.
Just before we wrap up the show, I want to mention one thing. Senator Kurt Bramble, who is, again, the sponsor of the Kratom Consumer Protection Act at the Utah State Legislature, he traveled to Indonesia to learn as much as he could about this. And his deep level of involvement in Kratom made me wonder if he maybe had a financial stake in it. And so I asked him about that.
What did he say?
I have no economic interest in a Kratom business.
And just for the record, when I pressed, Senator Bramble also told me that nobody in his family is invested in kratom either. And I just say that because I figured that that would be a question pressing on people's minds as they listen to this. I guess that does it. Now, in the Hive, listeners who happen to have seen the same awning that I saw are as up to speed as I am on what that strange word means.
Man, what a great service we provide here. Roger, I have done a number on your show.
No, I disagree. I like the first person perspective, and I just want to mention that you know, KCBW didn't ask you to put your life on the line for radio.
I did it for science.
In the Hive is a production of KCBW, a listener-supported independent public radio resource.
You can find podcasts of this and our other local programs at kcbw.org. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw.
Thanks, Andrew. And thanks to you for listening. Please tune in again next week.